everyone. Welcome to One Seat Over, a Yale Herald podcast centered around the untold stories of the people you go to school with. Because the person you keep getting placed in a Zoom breakout room with, your Durfee's nemesis, and the one person you once made meaningful eye contact with in the Zeta basement all have incredible lives and stories to tell. And it's about time we listen. So grab a seat and join us. I'm your host, Mika Patel, a junior in Davenport majoring in sociology. And today on this inaugural episode, four Yalies are going to be answering the question, where are you? Where are you going? In a semester that's brought new meaning to going to school at Yale, with half of our student body displaced all over the world, it's a perfect time to reflect on the ideas of place and home, how these spaces define us, and how we, in some ways, may define them. Today, we have four storytellers from different class years calling in from different corners of the world. We have Khalil Green, TD 21, calling in from Maryland, Aaron Maglor, TD 23, calling in from New York City, Kennedy Bennett, DC 22, from Charleston, and Malia Munley, Silliman 23, from Hawaii. Without further ado, let's get to our storytellers. How are y'all? Good, cool. Are you guys nervous? Because I definitely am. yourselves, yeah. And so before we jump right into stories about place, let's talk about so where are you guys calling in from? Just like a brief, like, intro. We can start with Aaron.
Me? Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm calling in from, Queens, New York. I want to make some argument about how it's the best borough, but I honestly think that's Brooklyn. So, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Khalil.
I'm calling in from North Bethesda, Maryland. There's no boroughs here, it's just a suburb, so there's no argument to make.
Kennedy.
Yeah, I'm calling in also from the suburbs, but the suburbs of Charleston, South Carolina.
Awesome. Malia.
I'm calling in from Honolulu, Hawaii, so an island, a little different, but yeah.
Cool. Okay, so our first storyteller, we have Khalil Green, a senior, and Timothy Dwight, calling in from Maryland.
Thank you for that introduction. So the finance site Wallet Hub ranks the place that I grew up in, Germantown, Maryland, as the 7th most diverse city in America. It ranks the place that I was born in, Silver Spring, Maryland, as the 6th most diverse city in America. And then it ranks a town just across the street from mine, Gaithersburg, Maryland, as the 4th most diverse place in all of America. And all of these cities are in a county called Montgomery County, Maryland. And Montgomery County, Maryland is where I grew up, and it's where I'm from, and it's where I am right now as I take this remote semester from my brother's apartment, just doing what I can to keep in touch with the Yale community from my home, which is about 200 miles away from New Haven. So Montgomery County is on what has been historically been Piscataway land. So it is home of the Piscataway, Seneca, and Susquehannock indigenous peoples. But after obviously centuries of colonization, the forced migration and the human trafficking of African peoples, and then waves of immigration, the landscape of the county looks very different than it did all those years ago. So as I said before, Montgomery County is known as being a very, very, very diverse place, but unfortunately it's also known as being a very segregated place, especially when it comes to the public school system. So what my story is gonna talk about today and what I'm here to present is just how that segregation has kind of poisoned and permeated the diversity, and where something can be so beautiful in terms of the different cultures and peoples that live here, it can also be very ugly in how those peoples are segregated and separated and not able to coexist as they should. So first I'm gonna highlight my elementary school. Start off when I was 5 years old, I went to a place called Daly Elementary, which is an elementary school in a part of Montgomery County called Germantown. So Daly Elementary is what you call a Title I elementary school, which means that a majority of the students who go there are low income and it needs federal assistance because of this. So that elementary school had majority Black and Brown population. I really enjoyed it, but looking back, I can see some things that separated from private schools and other schools throughout the county. For example, the lunches were nothing more than bread and cheese some days. And if you didn't pay for your lunch, you didn't have money in your lunch account, they would literally take it away and just give you a carton of milk and like a piece of lettuce, and that would be your lunch for all of the day, which is pretty insane. But at the time, it was just all I knew. There was also overcrowding of classrooms, which means there wasn't any hope of there being a 10-to-1 teacher ratio. It was so overcrowded that they had to install like 5 different trailers outside of the school building to house the extra classrooms that they had to have by hiring just like makeshift teachers to come in, because it was so overcrowded throughout my childhood. And there are other little things that, looking back, I can't remember, because at the time I just thought they were so normal, but they really were indicative of a lack of funding and a lack of support for this school. So my middle school, which was called Neillsville Middle School, was also nicknamed the Prison on the Hill because it had a lot of the same problems as the elementary school, but on top of it, the facilities were really, really, really poor. There were cracks in the ceilings. There was all sorts of piping issues and asbestos, and there's just a lot of issues with the school. Additionally, when I was in sixth grade, which is my first year in middle school, they had to remove our principal because our school failed to reach No Child Left Behind policies. So I'm painting this picture because I want to make it clear that my elementary school and my middle school were pretty much, in terms of locations, victims of this lack of funding, of the segregation, of these resource constraints on schools like mine. But when I was going into high school, I tested into a magnet program called Poolsville High School's STEM Magnet. And when I went to Poolsville, which was on the opposite side of the county, about an hour away from where I'm from, the world was so different in terms of education. There were science facilities, there were engineering rooms where you had all types of tools that you can use at your disposal. There was everything under the sun that someone could want for a great high school, a great school, and a great educational experience. But on top of that, the makeup of the classroom was extraordinarily different. Not only was the student-to-teacher ratio much smaller, but also the racial and ethnic makeup was incredibly different. For example, out of 240 students, I was the only Black person to graduate from the magnet program when I was there. On top of that, Poolsville as a town was made up of majority white residents because it was on a rural side of county where they thought that placing magnet school would not disrupt and not be affected by the community at large and anything that was going on there. And I think that was definitely coded for racial issues and lack of funding and lack of support. So around the time that I was graduating high school, there was an incident where back in my kind of home region where my high school that I would have gone to without the magnet program was, one of my close friends from middle school was shot and killed in an offense that was speculated to be involved with like drugs or something like that. I'm choking up a little bit, but one of my friends, I'm gonna restart here. When I was in high school, the day before graduation, I found out that one of my friends, who I was really close to in middle school, was shot and killed in what was suspected to be drug-related crimes. And around this time, it was a time of my reflection for how different my path had been from a lot of the people that I went to school with when I was very young. And it really made me reflect on how the differences in that path and how that divergence really affected my trajectory in a way that allowed me opportunities to come to a place like Yale, but really left behind a lot of the people that I grew up with and did not afford them those same opportunities, that same support in the education system, that same support outside of school, and all of the different resources that are really funneled into students that are deemed gifted and talented or accepted into a program like a magnet program in one way or another. So at that moment, once again, I was in high school. By then I'd already been accepted to Yale. I went back into all of my yearbooks, right? And I think that's when I was able to craft this story and come up with kind of the narrative that I'm going to talk to you, like I'm talking about right now, is that I was able to look at my elementary school yearbook and see the diversity of the faces, the people that I knew growing up. But I also recognized that if I looked them up on Instagram or whatever I did to keep in touch with them, a lot of them weren't necessarily going to college or weren't necessarily going to have like a stable income or stable job coming out of high school. Going to middle school, I saw my friend, his name was Shadi. He signed my yearbook and he said, "I know you're gonna do great things, Khalil. I'm really excited to see where you go." And he wasn't necessarily, he wasn't able to really go anywhere. Like his life was ended so young. It just, in terms of trajectory and in terms of paths, in terms of opportunity, it was cut short for Shadi. So I kind of just felt guilty, to be honest. I felt very guilty that I was able to go to Yale, have all these prospects for me and know that no matter what, I'd be okay coming out of college because I'd be able to get a job. I'd be able to move out to where I wanted to, wherever I wanted to go. But it also ignited something within me that I keep to this day, and that is the motivation to advocate specifically in places where oppression and lack of opportunity is overlooked because the numbers tell a different story from the realities. So in Montgomery County, once again, it's diverse. There's a lot of different racial and ethnic minorities and marginalized communities that make up the residents and the people who live here. But at the end of the day, it's a place where through policy, through history, through socioeconomic factors, people are put into places where they either will get opportunities or they won't get opportunities. And there are some paths that the county will prop up, like magnet schools or private schools or charter schools or anything like that, where students who would lack opportunity otherwise are able to access it. But at the end of the day, this creates a sort of issue in those people like me who come from these lack of opportunity places and all of a sudden get access to a world that they wouldn't have access to otherwise, but don't necessarily have the capacity or the knowledge on how to reach back and either remove those barriers or help more people get to where they are, so then they can work actively to remove those institutional barriers and that separation. And in terms of where I'm going and what I want to do with my life is that I want to learn more, because I think these issues stand out in a lot of different places, but at the end of the day, there's not necessarily a lot of solutions that are presented. So in terms of location, I'm here in Maryland right now. I attend Yale and I plan on going back to New Haven at some point. And then after that, I want to continue with both formal education through schooling and graduate school, but then also informal education by talking to people who I went to elementary and middle school with and who have different experiences and getting an understanding of their lives, so that through policy, through education, through awareness, I can make sure that I'm able to course correct and tie my past, present, and future in a way that I can be proud of, in a way that uplifts everyone, so there are no more educational and opportunity barriers along the lines of race and geography in my county.
That was awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I guess I'm wondering how you think your county is handling like COVID, especially because, you know, of course, like not everybody has access to like internet and like all these barriers that are there. And I'm wondering if you like have heard about your county and how they're handling it.
Yeah. So in terms, there's a few things that they're tackling. So in terms of like resources, there was a huge food shortage, and like not necessarily like a lack of food in terms of amount, but a lack of access to food and people being able to like go to a store and pay for it. So I was serving on a food security task force earlier this summer, and that did a great job of getting the word out to residents. And for example, one of my projects, I had to translate something to 6 different languages to once again encompass the diversity of Montgomery County and all the different foods and that people had to eat. And there's a lot of like cultural kind of disconnect in the people in the county who were serving the residents because they didn't necessarily know what cuisines were available. So that was something that, once again, the issue of diversity and access permeated. And when it comes to education, there is pretty much a repeat of what you see in a normal school year, and that they have a lot of funding, they have a lot of places that are getting the adequate resources in terms of technology for students to come in. And I think some schools have it where you're periodically able to go into school like on Mondays, Tuesdays, and others have it fully remote. But in terms of overall, there's no blanket answer because it depends on the region. And I haven't been in touch as much with like elementary and middle school. I have some high school friends still, but I'm assuming and I wouldn't be surprised if the same issues erupt in terms of COVID, but they're just exacerbated because of everything going on.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so for our next storyteller, the lovely Kennedy Bennett, my old sweet mate, a Davenport and junior calling from Charleston, South Carolina.
Thank you for introducing me, Mahika. So like Mahika said, I'm from South Carolina, about halfway between Washington, D.C. and Disney World as a point of reference. More specifically, I was born and raised in Mount Pleasant, a suburban town neighboring the Charleston Peninsula. Despite the misheld belief among many Yalees from the North in California, the South is not a monolith. South Carolina is a red state, but my district is blue. Charleston is robust with culture, like the Gullah Geechee, who are descendants of enslaved Africans and embrace the food, music, and artistry passed down from prior generations. Despite rapid residential development and gentrification, it maintains a local feel. In fact, a few years ago, one of the major shrimp boats sank, and it was covered on our local news for nearly a month. At the same time, the city is constantly confronted by its gruesome history. Many of these violent aspects are embedded and normalized, blending into the background. I honestly didn't realize how strange some things were until I left for college and returned home on break. Like a plantation, Boone Hall Plantation specifically, showcasing a giant billboard along the highway, advertising itself as the number one plantation in the Charleston area by USA Today. We're always surrounded by vestiges of American slavery. The city's history is alive and well. I can't pinpoint when exactly I became politically engaged. Growing up, I always remember the news being on the TV as I got ready for school, on the radio as my mom drove me there, and in the evening. I suppose trying to decipher the chaos and inequities in the world drove me to naively break down and solve some of the world's complexities. The weight or association of interning on Capitol Hill or working on a congressional campaign didn't exist in high school as it seems to in college. At the end of the day, I was a young person interested in democratic politics and platforms in South Carolina. From a national lens, the South really wasn't gaining attention. It wasn't until Stacey Abrams and Beto O'Rourke's 2018 campaigns that I noticed Southern politics receiving interest from larger groups. So as an 18-year-old freshly out of high school, it was fairly easy to get involved. I interned for Joe Cunningham, who at the time was running for South Carolina's first congressional district. It seemed like an uphill battle, him running against a Trump-backed Republican in South Carolina. All four or five of us interns would sit in foldable chairs in one office room working toward a common cause, raising X amount of dollars or reaching out to X number of potential supporters, all in efforts of getting Cunningham elected. But as I've gotten more involved in politics, it's become more confusing. At home, politics felt communal and local. At Yale, my peers spout political theory they learned in a seminar or recounted the most recent statistics from political pundits. Prior to college, I always wondered why political science was named exactly that. What qualities of this field make it so analytical and systematic? Sure, there are three branches of government, but how did this division relate to analyzing behaviors and structures? Up until this point, politics, to me at least, was a way of being involved in my community. I interned for a candidate who I believed would advocate for the interests of my town at the national level, securing resources and supporting legislation that would help us. As a side note, Cunningham, or Representative Cunningham, has done exactly that during his term. But now at Yale, I feel a chasm growing. Political engagement could mean advocating for one of your communities, but it could also mean something else. And it's the something else where I stumble and become a little disoriented. The something else could mean padding a resume for law school or profiting off the trauma of a marginalized community or something else entirely. And these reasons aren't inherently mutually exclusive. The 2020 election is monumental. Many voices on the news, on Twitter, are shouting demands at anonymous faces hidden behind screens. Phrases like, "we're going to fight like hell," proliferate on social media platforms. What do these phrases actually mean? Are there actionable steps to ensure that these phrases materialize? Whose voice is the loudest anyway? And where would I fit into this discussion? I'm Black, a woman, and my mom's a teacher. When I got into Yale, it felt like parts of my identity were commodified. In one part, I'm proud of who I am, and my lived experiences add merit to my political beliefs. But as I describe some of my lived experiences in relation to some other topic, these experiences are consumed by an audience, and I have no control over this consumption or how they are interpreted or how these individuals interact with these stories. So where am I now? If I haven't conveyed it yet, I'm a little lost and confused. I entered into politics through electoral work. It was energizing work, and I loved being a part of campaigns in my home state. But the power of a vote is diminished by voter suppression and gerrymandering. The integrity of our voting system is compromised. In the short term, I am registered to vote and have solidified my voting plan. But in the long term, I'm fully cognizant that greater discussion is needed about who these systems were created for and intended to help prosper. We live in a nation where the death of one individual ricochets the structure and future of an entire judicial system. When these discussions take place, I don't want a seat at the table because the table shouldn't even exist. The table implies exclusion, where only a select few were warranted an invitation, the exact antithesis of a democracy. So that is where I am now.
Awesome, thank you for sharing. I guess I'm wondering, I know you're in Dems. I'm wondering, sorry.
You got everybody laughing now. Okay.
So I guess I'm wondering, I know you're in Dems, so I'm wondering, like, and you're on Dems board, so you're really involved, and I know how much time you put into it. So I'm wondering, like, how it is sort of being remote and, like, with the election, the 2020 election coming up, like, what has that been like?
It's definitely been a challenge. But everyone who is on board and all of our members, we're all energized by 2020 in some way. Some are more drawn to electoral work. Some are more drawn to, like, structural change and legislation. And we've really just emphasized having space and room for everyone to essentially have access to the resources and support that they would need to commit to whatever political work they want to do. And we also make sure that we're, like, home to anyone across the left. So some may be more moderate and would have supported, like, Amy Klobuchar during, I guess, like, this time last year. But some are more on the left, like I am, and would support, like, Bernie or Warren, or may not even see those two as, like, left enough. So.
Awesome. And we have a question from Khalil, so you can go ahead and ask.
Yeah, my question is, which communities at Yale do you feel like are in politics for the right reason? Like, and that right reason is, I'm assuming, in this regard, is just community involvement, like fighting for a better world. And then which communities, or what, like, how many communities do you feel like are just doing it for that clout or that, like, resume booster?
Yeah, that's the thing, because these organizations aren't necessarily, like, all the same. And the other part, okay, I guess I'll answer this in two parts. One, going back to when I mentioned that the reasons for being politically engaged aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. So I think you may run into people who genuinely do want to fight for, like, women's rights or like human rights, but at the same time, they could be, like, a little calculating and ambitious, and they do know that it would be good work to have on their resume. So there are people who do have these two interests. I'm not trying to say, like, one is necessarily better than the other, although I'm pretty sure we would probably all have our own opinions on which does sound morally more sound. But it isn't mutually exclusive. And I think that's something probably among everyone at Yale, like, we are at Yale with reason, and we are all a little ambitious in our own ways. But it's just a matter of, like, how you funnel that. And then in terms of the organizations themselves, so there's so many political groups on campus, which I think is great, because if you're interested in something, there's probably work already going on that you could join in on. But I don't think that it's as much of the organization as it is like just individuals who, like, just depending on their interests. So, and I think this may be something you could find within any organization, not even necessarily to Yale, although we are at Yale. So, I mean, it would make sense to like talk specifically to it, that the organizations can't necessarily help who's drawn toward them. I think all they can do is like provide the resource and support to help them make changes, hopefully positive ones, in their respective communities. But I don't think I could like draw a line at like which organizations are good and which ones are not.
Sweet, thank you so much again, Kennedy. And before we hear from our next storyteller, we wanted to highlight a cause worth discussing. So shout out to Boys and Girls Club of New Haven. Last year they were at risk of closing because they didn't have enough funding, and they might be in the same situation this year. So make sure you check out their website and donate. And next up, we have Aaron Maglor, a Timothy Dwight sophomore, calling in from New York City.
Thanks, Mahika. Yeah, you know, the prompt of where are you, where are you going is an interesting one, because I think the natural third piece to that is where are you from? And that's a question to which for the past 5 years I've been giving the most needlessly and obnoxiously overdrawn answer imaginable to anyone who asks. The short answer to where are you from is New York City. But for some reason or another, I usually end up finding it appropriate, and most of the time it's not, to explain that my legal address is in Delaware, which of course itself prompts an explanation of how and why I ended up in Delaware in the first place, which ultimately leads to this uncomfortably long personal history that includes three things from the list entitled Top 10 Things No One Ever Wants to Talk About, like ever: separated parents, New England boarding schools, and the entire state of Delaware. So naturally, I am now going to recite that same uncomfortably long personal history to you. So I was born and grew up in Queens, New York City. My parents separated when I was pretty young, and in 2015, when I was 14 years old, my mom married my stepdad, and they moved to Middletown, Delaware to be closer to his job in Wilmington. Less than a month later, I started at a boarding school in what is the hub of American multiculturalism, Concord, New Hampshire. That was a joke. I want to be really, really clear. That is a joke. Anyway, I was there for all 4 years of high school. I only came home for breaks and summers. And then when I did come home, I split my time about 80-20 between New York and Delaware, respectively. I didn't and still don't have any friends in Delaware, just on account of the timing of the move. So it never made sense for me to stay there for more than 2 weeks at a time, if that. You know, I went primarily for family and for the Wawa, and that was about it. And while I do now consider myself fully indoctrinated into Wawa subculture, I still know practically nothing about Delaware, and very much consider New York City home. So for all those reasons, the pandemic has been an interesting change of pace, to say the least. During that week in March, when the state of COVID-19 in the US went straight from like curious to terrifying without stopping anywhere in between, I was in Delaware for what was supposed to be only 3 or 4 days before I left for a spring break trip with a high school friend. But fast forward to the end of that week, and I had canceled my trip due to safety concerns. And fast forward 4 months later, I was still in Delaware, and I was, you know, taking shelter in this state that still felt largely foreign to me. So it was definitely bizarre and trying to go from spending no more than 2 weeks at a time in Delaware to spending an entire third of a year there. But I think what was even stranger was watching from afar as the coronavirus just devastated New York. You know, I hope it goes without saying that I feel incredibly grateful to have been able to stay out of the city at a time when 800 people a day were losing their lives to COVID, but I also, excuse me, I also felt very much like I should have been there. You know, it's where I grew up. It's where the vast majority of my family still lives. It's where I am now. It's, you know, where I've made some of my fondest memories, my best friends. And it felt almost perverse to be just sitting comfortably on my couch in Delaware, watching the news footage of Times Square being completely deserted, which in my opinion is how it should always be, but that's another 10 minute talk. Or just, you know, listening to testimonies from these healthcare workers and hospital staff who were just massively overworked. Now, could I have changed any of that if I were in New York? Obviously not. I would have been locked inside my apartment, afraid for my life and the lives of my loved ones, but I still felt weirdly guilty. And if I didn't feel guilty, I just felt like another one of the many Southampton socialites who had like grabbed their best Brooks Brothers set from the closet of their Upper East Side apartment and then like fled to their summer homes without ever looking back. And I think that's a feeling worse than guilt. And even when I didn't feel either of those things, you know, I just missed New York. It was suffering and struggling, and sometimes it was celebrating, and I wanted to be there. You know, I wanted to be in my city. When George Floyd was killed and the so-called second pandemic, that is racism, overtook national headlines again, I realized another reason why I was so deeply missing New York. You know, I'm not gonna waste any time trying to argue that New York is less racist than Delaware, because I'm not sure it's ever a question of less racist so much as less overtly racist, but it's certainly more diverse. You know, I hate to say this because the term is really it's so corny and it's so overused, but everything you've heard about New York being a melting pot, you know, like it is true. As much as I hate the term, I think, at least for me, it's true. You know, seeing myself and my family members and my friends of color not just widely represented, but also positively represented on a daily basis is what I'm used to in New York. And, you know, Delaware is by no means the most homogenous place in the nation. In fact, Middletown, you know, to give credit where credit is due, is actually surprisingly ethnically diverse, but it's no New York City. And I'm reminded of that every time I pass a car with a Confederate flag bumper sticker or a house that just has Trump 2020 signs plastered over the lawn like those stupid lawn flamingos. It's like, you know, I didn't think anything was worse than the lawn flamingos, but here we are. You know, I grew my hair out this summer, partially out of choice and partially because no barbershops were open. And, you know, I worried when I was walking around alone at night that my afro would make me seem more threatening. And I don't think that's ever something I would feel in New York, at least the places in New York that I most frequently inhabit. So, you know, I guess in the end, it all comes down to with whom and where you grieve. You know, when COVID was at its worst, I wanted to be in my city. I wanted to be clanging pots and pans from my window every night at 7 o'clock to honor the first responders and medical personnel. And when George Floyd died, I wanted to be in my city, marching with people who looked like me and, you know, felt this pain the way I did. So when I finally came back to New York at the end of July, you know, the protests had died down somewhat, and the city was weirdly one of the safest places to be in the country in terms of new COVID infection rates. So it was this strange experience of having watched the grief on the television and then come back to live in something that sort of resembled normalcy, which was really, really strange. And I know strange is the new normal, but it was still strange. You know, I suppose it's good to be reminded of the reasons why you love a place, though. Distance makes the heart grow fonder, whatever that cheesy saying is. And as much as I despise the fact that I have allowed myself to add to the already far too big catalog of essays and think pieces and podcasts about New York, it's really, there's just too many. I mean, it's, we need to stop. There's too many people writing about New York and talking about New York. It's like, okay, I get it. How about like Chicago or something? I don't know. I do understand where they're coming from, you know, I have to say. It's a pretty cool place, if I might be so bold.
Awesome, thank you for sharing that. I am wondering, like, are you planning on moving back to New York City after graduating? And I'm sure this must be like a question you've probably pondered and that you've been asked before, but and if not, like if this is not already assumed, then a lot of what you're talking about, I think it relates back to community. And you have this like really strong sense of community from New York. And I'm wondering if like you believe that you need that like sometime in the future for wherever you settle down.
Yeah. In terms of whether or not I want to be back in New York after college, like ideally, yes. Financially, it's a different story just because it's like, you know, you like have to pay an arm and a leg for like 1 square foot in New York. You know, it's like, here's this cardboard box for $3,000 a month. You're like, what? How does, okay. So yeah, you know, it depends on, I mean, I have a lot of family here, so I do think I am lucky in that I could probably, like I wouldn't be on my own or anything. But yeah, long-term, I'd definitely like to be in New York. I do think community is important wherever I end up. You know, it's an interesting question in terms of like whether or not that's something that, whether or not that's one of my non-negotiables for wherever I end up, because I haven't really imagined a life for myself that's not in New York. So I haven't even thought about like the difficulties that come with creating a new community from scratch, if that makes sense. I mean, I guess I've done it at school, but like, I think that's different because, you know, schools, whether it's high school or college, always have a lot of things in place that facilitate that, which is not necessarily the case when you're just moving to a new place to live long-term. But yeah, I do think community is really important. I think something feeling familiar is really important too.
Awesome. Just a quick other question. What is the stereotype of New York that you just hate the most?
You know, I want to say that it's the stereotype that we're rude, but like it's true. Like I can't, like people are so rude here. I remember this one time I was walking, and I pride myself on being a fast walker because, you know, I just think you kind of have to be if you're living in a crowded city. But I remember this one time I was walking, and I thought I was walking pretty fast, and this woman literally pushes past me and then like flings her cigarette like back behind her, and I just got a face full of smoke. And then I watched her like strut like into the sunset like she was at like New York Fashion Week. I was like, what's... like, what is going on here, you know? But I do think the flip side to that is that for every, like, really rude and dismissive New Yorker, there's one really caring New Yorker who would, like, give you the shirt off their back. That might be a bit too far, but I also don't think that's, like, COVID sanitary. But, you know, I think the rudeness has its flip side as well, yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Okay, next up we have Malia Munley, a Silliman sophomore calling from Hawaii.
Hi, thank you, Mahika. Yeah, my name is Malia. I'm a sophomore, but I'm taking the fall off, so I'm like kind of in the weird limbo space. And yeah, I'm calling in from Honolulu, Hawaii. I was born here. My mom's family is from here. I did live on the continental US, or the mainland as we call it, for a few years, but the majority of my time has been spent here in Hawaii, and it's definitely the place that I call home. And when I say I'm from Hawaii, people are like, whoa, because they think it's super different. And honestly, it is from like little things. Like we call flip-flops slippers and literally wear them everywhere, formal or informal, or go barefoot. Like that's totally okay to not wear your shoes to school. I definitely forgot my shoes many times because I was in that habit. The beaches here are definitely better than anywhere else, gotta say. The poke chains that you see on the mainland, like we have in New Haven as well, are not legit poke. They're still very good, but they're like not Hawaiian style poke, even though they advertise that. But it also, like, more seriously, definitely isn't as glamorous as like the ads and influencers make it seem. Like we have a lot of overpopulation, pollution, especially of like our beaches and waters, like high living prices and low wages and like big socioeconomic divides because of this. And then like a history of colonization and gentrification. So I think that's really important to think about when referencing Hawaii, because I think that's often overlooked for like the tropical beach location. And I do want to make clear that like I'm from here, but I'm not Hawaiian. And even though my mom's family came over like in the earliest 20th century from Japan, I recognize that we're guests here and like it's really important to be respectful of the land and the history and the native language and culture, like for people living here and anyone who visits. But yeah, no matter like what in Hawaii, I still really love it. It's really different from Yale in terms of the people and the style even and the warmth and also the diversity and just the culture. It's kind of a difference that's hard to describe unless you're from here. Like anyone who's from Hawaii immediately knows what you're talking about, but it's really hard to put into words because it's just a feeling. But by the end of high school, I was really ready to go off to college. And I think a lot of people my age are, because it does feel like you're stuck on a rock in the middle of the ocean, which you literally are because you're thousands away from everything else. But going to Yale and then coming back over winter break, I realized just how beautiful and special Hawaii is. And why people return, because a lot of people come back during college or after college because it's just so different. But also why I feel like for me and my growth, I can't come back for a while. I think that in terms of like my creative goals and like career goals and like personal goals, it's just not the place for me right now. I think it's a great place to grow up and raise kids, have a family if I choose to do that. So yeah, that's where I'm at with that right now. But I also think even for people who do come back to Hawaii, it's really great to have that time away because here you are so isolated and in such a bubble and you don't have the type of violence and huge differences in political views. And even though there's racism here, it's not as like explicit and like extreme as on the mainland. So I even found myself in high school, like even though I try not to, disconnecting from what the rest of the world was like because it's just so insular here. So I think it's very beneficial to go to the mainland and experience that. But yeah, I guess like that's kind of Hawaii and where I'm like actually from, but more about like where I want to go and where I'm at now, not just physically. So if you know me, you know that I'm like really into theater and performing. I guess that's like my brand, I don't know. But yeah, from the time I was like literally 2 years old, I got this like toy plastic ukulele and I just like would play that everywhere for everyone, which is really embarrassing, but cute at that age. But I didn't actually start like really getting into performing until fifth grade when like I finally had the courage to admit to my family that I'm not into sports like you think I am and wanted me to be, but I actually really love the arts. And this was like really transformative for me because it really helped me to learn and to grow, especially because I was so shy as a kid. And it really was and is still like a method for me to express and sort through emotions in a way that I don't think I feel comfortable doing as like me personally, Malia. And so then also like when I went through rough times, theater was definitely an outlet and a way for me to escape my reality. And I think it's also because like I love performing because Hawaii is a very like has a very empathetic culture. And I feel personally that I am able to understand emotions really well. Like in a conversation, I'm really good at understanding people and their beliefs, even if I don't agree with them, which other people have pointed out as well. Like my friends say I'm the moderator. But yeah, I think this can make it, because I'm so focused on trying to understand what other people are feeling, it can make it difficult for me to sort out like my beliefs and what I'm feeling. And I think that's partially because of our culture here, and also because it is a very like humble to a fault culture. You're taught like not really to speak up as much, and to just get along and be nice to everyone, which is super important. But I found myself, especially coming to Yale, sometimes struggling to like really advocate for myself. And I'm like, if I can advocate for my characters and like other people, why can't I do the same for myself? So I think that this has been a major growing point with theater and leaving Hawaii as well. And also, I feel like I'm not always the best with my words. I sometimes get really nervous, and I just kind of ramble and feel like I never really say the right thing, partially because I'm scared it's going to be stupid or like make me sound dumb, or be offensive or hurtful in some way. So with like theater, and like I also really like music and singing, like you have the words and you have melodies that are indicative of how the character is feeling and what they're trying to say. So they're really there and they're beautifully crafted for you to lean on. And all you have to do is kind of understand the motion and reasoning behind them, which is what I like to do and I feel comfortable doing. Yeah, so that can be easier for me than coming up with my own words and thoughts. I think that's also part of the reason why I'm really interested in cognitive science, and I think that might be my second major, because that's also figuring out why and how people act and feel and think the way that they do. Yeah, so that was kind of like where I am now, and why I am that way. And in terms of thinking about the future, I think that a dream would be to pursue a career in the arts and leave Hawaii for a while and possibly come back. But I don't know exactly. I'm not entirely sure. I think that being involved in the arts, even if it's not with performing, it's scary because there's a lot of financial insecurity. The state of the industry right now with COVID, also being Asian American, times are changing, but there isn't a ton of representation. And I think I grew up like under the assumption that theater was very all-inclusive, because here everyone is so diverse and so mixed. So it literally doesn't matter. You can just be a part of something if you want to. But I definitely realized just how inaccessible and inequitable theater is. And so I'm also really passionate about trying to change that. And so possibly there's like, that could be a path for me as well. And something that I've also been struggling with in terms of where I want to go, and that I've spoken with many other friends about and artists during this time, is that like considering the state of the world and the nation and the injustices that so many groups face, is it really selfish for me to want to pursue just like my passion? Shouldn't I be doing something for the greater good? And what is my responsibility? And the answer is, I don't know. I've been using this time to try to really be involved in other like facets that I'm interested in, and getting more into politics and like volunteering with organizations and working. I'm working with the Michigan Democratic Party as an intern, because this is such an important time. So I don't exactly know the answer to that, but I think I also remind myself and others who share the same fears that art is also important, especially during really difficult times, and it can connect people in such a unique way and also provide so much joy and release, especially for kids. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. And I'm nervous, but also excited to see what comes next, because I'm really not sure what that looks like.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing. We're also very excited to see what comes up next for you. I have a question. Did you start theater in Hawaii, or was this a passion you picked up at Yale?
I started in Hawaii. So yeah, around elementary school is when I kind of got into it. But I've been continuing to do it I've been continuing to do theater at Yale.
Awesome. What's the art scene like in Hawaii?
It's not that developed. Hawaii has like its own art, like hula, and different Polynesian styles of dance. But in terms of theater, it's pretty much just like community theaters and school theaters. So that's what I did growing up. And I think why a lot of like potential artists or people who want to pursue that leave, but then come back to have their families and then like they get involved in local theater.
Awesome. Thank you again. And that's it for today's episode of One Seat Over. Thank you to our storytellers for taking a chance on the Scrappy podcast and sharing parts of who you are with us. We hope you learned and laughed. And now we want to hear from you. Our next episode's theme will be, why did you do that? Stories of mishaps, mistakes, and attempts at recovery. If you have a story or know someone with a story, please email us at oneseatover@gmail.com. Every idea is a good idea, and we have a team of editors ready to help make your work the best it can be. It's low stress, lots of fun, and we want everyone's stories to be heard. If we want to make Yale a more welcoming space, it starts with you. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks again to our wonderful storytellers, and we hope to hear your stories soon. Catch you in the next one.